My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of the community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
To Intravenous on Wednesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. for music and talk radio about all things, all genders. Discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through an intersectional feminist lens, our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony. Intravenous every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.
And welcome back to Sociologic here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where you are currently tuned in to Sociologic, which I have just stated. You can tell it is that time of the evening and my brain is not working. I am Rebecca. I'm going to be your host for about the next 25 minutes up until 8 p.m., where Bitcoover will take over with our music coordinator, Connor. Very exciting show. Definitely recommend staying tuned for that. And yeah, the songs you just heard were People Watching by Sam Fender, off of his album People Watching, which was his latest song. I said songs, we just played one. Again, my brain is fried. It's that time. We have been talking a bit about national identity, nationalism, the difference between the two, and the theoretical foundations of national identity. And I want to kind of go into the key components of it now. So if we look at it from a historical context, because history has played a very key role in national identity with the rise of nation states in the 18th and 19th centuries, which involved the creation of centralized political institutions, standardized languages, and a national education system, which are all big factors into national identity. Because these all cultivated a sense of unity and loyalty among the population. And a very big impact historically would also be colonialism. We can see that this had a significant impact here in Canada, but globally. And that's because colonial powers imposed arbitrary borders and created artificial nations that led to this kind of emergence of hybrid identities. And if we then look post-colonial states, they are now often having to navigate these challenges of forging a cohesive sense of self, which is what national identity is all about, but that it's amidst such diversity, both ethnically, linguistically, culturally. So it's left it a very difficult state, and we know, like, colonialism, there was very little good that came out of it, if any. So the historical context in national identity is a very key part to it. Another very key part is cultural elements. Now, this is talking about more shared practices, traditions, symbols, all of these things that contribute to a sense of belonging and collective self-perception. I was about to say perspiration. Perception. So for example, language, this is a hugely significant marker of identity, and it serves as a medium of communication. It's a symbol of cultural heritage. Another good example is national anthems, flags, which I've mentioned as well, nation celebrated holidays. All of these reinforce a collective national identity. And another cultural element that I mentioned previously is education systems. Education systems are so crucial in national identity because they are the infrastructure that is transmitting, passing on national culture. You see this through like curricula and textbooks. They all give knowledge about history, heroes, the villains, the values. This whole process is like a form of socialization, which again, me and Kaylin have spoken about in a theory deep dive, if you want to check it out, on the playlist of under our playlist in cgsf.ca website. But this process of socialization is, you're learning all about your nation, essentially. And it helps instill kind of this pride and identity with young people of where they're from, and socializing you into society to have this national identity. And I spoke actually about this when I first came here. Because I didn't take history to a far level in education. I dropped it at the age of 14 when I was allowed to. I could either pick history or geography, or I could do both, and I picked geography. And so I don't know about further on if I'd taken history, but from up to where I was, where it was compulsory to do it, I didn't know anything about Britain's colonizing history. And obviously coming over here, it has a very lasting impact with Indigenous peoples. And I learned all of that when I got here at the age of 20. I didn't know any of that. And that is from a place that I've been born and raised and have not left. So we see again how this, like, obviously history, like historically, UK's not going to want to be teaching all of the new generations about all the pitfalls and everything that Britain did wrong in history and all of the, I guess, downsides to it. They only want you to know the positives, but it fuels this national identity of like pride and unity. But you don't know the flip side of all the damage caused, all the hurt caused, all of the, I guess, destruction that happened from Britain's past, which is one thing where you see educational systems being so crucial in national identity. And then the final section is like looking more politically and social factors, which I said, national identity, nationalism, patriotism are all heavily politically linked. So all political institutions and policies shape national identity. For example, you've got citizenship laws, immigration policies. These all influence who and who isn't included in the national community, who is included and excluded when it comes to national identity. And political leaders and the elite often are using a rhetoric and symbols that are promoting unity and identity. You'll notice as well, it particularly like amps up when there's times of crisis or conflict. So like I said before about the module that I took last year, they'll use words like us and them in political campaigns. And Trump's Make America Great Again hats, the MAGA hats, and his heavy use of the American flag are great examples of this. They create this real sense of patriotism and nostalgia amongst voters of like, we will make America great again together. You have to vote me though. And then it's, I represent all of us and we're all this collective unit. So that like I said, Trump is a great example of looking at national identity and how political institutions use national identity in their campaigns. Another one is social movements and societal organizations. They can play a huge role in shaping national identity because they challenge dominant narratives and they advocate for the inclusion of these disempowered groups. So for example, you're looking at like relevant to Canada, movements for Indigenous rights. You look at stuff like gender equality, hashtag Me Too. All of these things lead for a more inclusive and like pluralistic sense of self within a nation rather than this like divide of us and them. So there's like, I would say, the positives and negatives when it comes to politics and national identity. Now, I want to move on and look a bit at patriotism because, as I said before, patriotism has this really strong link to national identity. So if you don't know what patriotism is very similar, but it focuses more on a love and like pride and sense of loyalty for one's country.
for one's people, for one's values. And nationalism, actually, it has this, but it emphasizes it way more on the nation's interests, and this being the key thing, the nation's superiority. So patriotism can promote like inclusivity and diversity more, because it's it focuses way more on like a love and sense of loyalty for one's country, like you're proud to be part of that country. But it does also pose challenges, because it also can lead to exclusion of minority groups who do not conform to this like dominant national identity that's being spread everywhere. So an example would be like July 4th celebrations in the US for Independence Day. This is a symbol of national unity and freedom. You see it everywhere. Fireworks, cakes, all of this, red, white, and blue everywhere. It's all a really strong reminder of the US unity and freedom and being proud to be US. I don't know how much of that's going to change this year, but we'll see. But you also have like Canada's multiculturalism policy, promoting diverse, inclusive understanding of the Canadian identity. You look at Australia's government's efforts to promote reconciliation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians through a variety of initiatives. So this is where patriotism can be seen politically, of promoting inclusivity and diversity, because it's promoting social cohesion. It's not promoting division, exclusion, superiority, things like that, which are more associated with nationalism. And yeah, like I said, patriotism, again, often utilized within the political world, it's a very key tool in mobilizing support and swaying public opinion with politicians. They often employ this like patriotic language to evoke feelings of national pride and unity, and then you associate them with that. So again, it uses the same tools of the flags, the national anthems with their campaign. You look at, again, I'm just going to say Trump, he's just such a good example of all of this. He highlights national achievements, historical milestones, uses red, white, and blue a lot. His slogan, Make America Great Again, very big one. But if you look at it in a UK context, I would say a big example would be Brexit referendum campaign in 2016. So the Brexit referendum was very topical because obviously we were voting on whether to leave or remain in the European Union, and the result was like 51% leave, 49% remain. So it was very, very close. But there was a lot of drama and controversy afterwards because the Brexit campaign twisted some facts and lied a little bit. But they, if you look at their campaign, they played a lot on sovereignty away from the EU and the national identity of like Britain as this big, powerful nation. It was framed as a time of like, we need a renewal, like a national renewal. We need to take people back to a time of Britain's historical strength. Remember what a great place we were and this big empire and the independence we had, because they pictured it as the EU was this like threat to their control, like to Britain's control over Britain. And this is where immigration came into it and border control, and there was a big like hissy fit over it. And the big Brexit, like I'd say the main campaigning point of Brexit was, if we vote to leave the EU, we'll get control of our borders and we can stop all of this immigration and we can make Britain great. Which wasn't true, because the influx of immigration was more to do with illegal immigration, not EU immigration. So when we left the EU, the only border control we got was against EU citizens. So we actually ended up losing a lot of the people that worked in the NHS, for example, and didn't really help deal with the volume of illegal immigration that was happening, which is now why you see in the news that it's a lot worse. And then it was a catalyst. It started this snowball of what I'm going to talk about with the Southport attacks and the rioting in England that's happened and the increase in anti-immigration sentiment that's seen in the UK. So yeah, that like the Brexit was a big one. It was like Brexit being like obviously Britain exit. There was a lot of red, white, and blue again. You see this like very similar things that are used throughout patriotism, national identity, and nationalism. So yeah, these are like a couple of the key events I would say in history with this. And I wanted to note about like one big patriotic symbol in the UK, which a lot of people question, and I've been asked about a lot, which is the royal family, the monarchy in England, well, in the UK. A lot of people question it. I've had a lot of people over here ask me my opinion on it and things, because it is a big signifier to the British national identity, and obviously I am from England. But the monarchies held a lot of historical power. It doesn't really anymore. But it also holds a lot of negative historical events, colonialism being this really big one. And instead of dissolving Parliament, dissolving the monarchy, they've kind of transitioned it to be more fitting for the 21st century. I still question whether it is fitting. But it's this, they're more of a tourist attraction to me. Like, that's how I see it. They bring a lot of tourism and economic activity. So they help the country economically just because they're this massive patriotic symbol. But they say they're a patriotic symbol, and this is like actually off of their website. They say that they are a focus for national identity, giving a sense of stability and continuity. And this is because they offer a sense of pride and unity to average citizens, and they're being as well, they're politically neutral. So it puts a separation between patriotism and nationalism, because politicians are not really involved as such. I disagree with this just because of how many scandals and how much they're in the news of whether they are actually this stable patriotic symbol anymore. Because we look at, for example, the big one, Prince Harry and Meghan splitting from royal duties and living in the United States now. How is that a good patriotic sense of unity in the United Kingdom when you have two members of the royal family leave because of a bunch of comments made about the race of the one of, I think, I don't know if it was one or both of the babies that they have, and a lot of insults to Meghan herself. You also have a whole load of scandals around Prince Andrew, which is a whole other thing. He is riddled with scandals, the main one being his connections to Jeffrey Epstein. So I don't understand how the monarchy is used in this way as this sense of unity and pride for Britain, when there's so many negative things attached to them, I would say. And like Princess Diana as well, the history behind Princess Diana, which I don't really have time to get into, is a whole other thing as well, of like, she was a big turning point for the royal family changing, of being like how the royal family should be acting versus how they were, which, if it was me, I personally wouldn't want that as a symbol of the nation with all the negative connotations that's happening with them. But the crown is, I would say, it's the sense of patriotism more to the public, because they're politically neutral, and they offer entertainment and distractions. You see all these scandals I've just spoken about, they're a constant source of news. So it keeps, I guess, the UK interested in them, and it keeps tourism interested in them because they're always in the news. I don't know. But I don't see them as a sense of stability and continuity, which is what they use as the justification for why they're a focus of national identity in the UK. But everyone has their own opinions on them. I don't really know how much more relevant they're going to be, how long they should stay. I don't know. But yeah, we're coming up actually to the end of the hour, and I want to talk a bit about extremism and behavior influence of national identity. So I'm going to maybe quickly rush into this, because I think it's important to look at national identity and how national identity and nationalism are two different concepts, but the lines can blur. And this results to ultra-nationalism, so extreme nationalism, where there is this belief of superiority of one's own nation, and it manifests with this like hostility and aggression towards other nations and groups that are perceived as different. And a really big example of this is the rioting that happened in the UK last year in 2024. It marked a very clear escalation in nationalist extremism, because it followed an attack in Southport, Liverpool, where three girls under the age of 10 were murdered at a Taylor Swift dance class, alongside multiple attendees being injured. And it was all done by a 17-year-old boy at the time. He was he was a week away from turning 18, so he's 18 now. And the sentencing happened a couple months ago, actually. But this attack was a catalyst for a whole bunch of riots that went through the whole of summer last year. And I think it really highlighted this essential need that we need to be addressing nationalism, extreme nationalism, national identity, and this institutional racism that at times supports the extremist viewpoints. And it was a reminder, I think, to everyone, the dangers that is coming with normalizing hateful ideologies such as xenophobia, misogyny, white supremacy, etc., etc. All of these are being normalized. And the Southport attacks, like I said, they were a catalyst to attacks on vulnerable groups. And it led to this huge widespread unrest that was seen all over the UK. And it then led to a reinforcement of this anti-immigrant rhetoric and sentiment. We were seeing incidents of firebombings in a migrant processing center in Dover. There were other attacks on facilities housing asylum seekers. I remember seeing a post that was sharing a bunch of locations of immigration centers and lawyers, and there was threats of attacks. Immigration lawyers were needing protection officers with them. And this was all happening from the whole of the summer last year. And it led to far-right groups kind of capitalizing on this. For example, White Lives Matter and Identity England, they twisted the narrative to normalize the riots and to normalize this act of violence as a justified response by the, quote, British people towards what happened. And there was a lot of sharing of information about protest locations from these people and disinformation about the Southport attacker's identity. Now, this led to, even though he was under 18 and could remain unknown, they ended up releasing his identity because of these far-right groups capitalizing on it and spreading so much disinformation. They had to release his identity out of safety for everyone else. And when they released his identity, I don't know if it helped or not, because the boy is a black boy, but he is born and raised in Wales. But the fact that he was black really fueled the anti-immigration sentiment that was kind of in the background of all of this. And that was a big part of the riots, being like, we've got British young girls dying because of immigration and because of immigrants and things like that. Whereas that wasn't true. His parents came from Rwanda, but he was born and raised in England. In Wales, in the United Kingdom. So he was not an immigrant. But it fueled all of this. And then you saw a lot of white British people throwing bricks at police and getting very heated over the big problem, quote, problem that was immigration. And then these far-right groups also did a big reiteration on the defense of free speech to justify all of this behavior and to justify everything. So it was like a snowball effect that happened because of this big nationalistic, I don't even know if that's a word, nationalism viewpoint, that Britain, there was phrases being thrown out like, we need to make Britain white again and white Britain and things like that, which the Southport attacks were a catalyst from, because obviously the perpetrator was not white. So that's where you can see it going very extreme and influencing behavior. Ended up being 600 plus people arrested from that, and they were aging from I think 11 to above the 60s of that's the age demographic. So you're getting people that are ignorant on the subject getting arrested and getting a criminal record because of this. And it's all because we're normalizing hateful ideologies that are stemming from nationalism and going to the extreme. So yeah, that was a bit rushed at the end. Do apologize. I was just noticing that we're coming up to the top of the hour, where Connor will take over with a much more, I'd say, lighthearted topic with his chiptune music on Bitcoover. So yeah, I hope you all somewhat enjoyed my topic. Maybe you got educated in something you weren't really sure on, or learned something new, learned something about the UK. Maybe you'll look at politicians with a different lens, kind of addressing how they're using certain symbols, colours and choices of words. But yeah, I want to finish with a really old song, a 1980s song. It is a song that I really love. It's called Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes off of her album Mistaken Identity. And this will be my one hit for the show. I haven't played a hit in a long time because we like to play the underrepresented music here on CJSF. But I've been really obsessed with this song, so I do want to share it with you all. And I hope you all have a good rest of your evening and a good rest of your week.
Her hair is hollow gold, her lips sweet surprise, her hands are never cold, she's got Betty Davis eyes, she'll turn her music on you, you won't have to think twice, she's pure as New York snow, she got Betty Davis eyes.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.